Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a film critic. I write for The Wrap. And everybody calls me Bibbs. Hey, Whitney?
Yes?
What's the word, hummingbird? What's the tail nightingale?
Sasquatch. Did you hear about Hugo and Kim?
They're going steady!
Did they really get pinned? My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film, and we're both fans of Bye Bye Birdie.
Yeah. It's a good musical.
It's an okay musical.
It's whimsical. Yeah. It's a good time. this is the podcast where you write into the critically acclaimed network. You send us your questions, your concerns. Do you disagree with us about stuff? Do you want us to give you suggestions for your homework? Hey, better us than ChatGPT. I used to say, don't ask us to do your homework for you. And now I'm like, man, I don't know. If the option is ChatGPT, I guess I'll do it.
Better anything than ChatGPT.
Well, better doing your own goddamn work than ChatGPT, but yeah. I digress. Here's how it works. You send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or you can send us mail to our P.O. box, which we did not check this week.
No, but if we got letters, we'll get them.
Well, yes. But we'll read them as soon
as
we can.
That is, get them from the post office.
Yeah. Sorry about this. Whitney's let us down.
It's busy.
Yeah. But what is our P.O. box, Whitney?
Send us an actual physical letter or a postcard or whatever you like to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Every time we haven't checked our P.O. box for like a week or two, I get this image in my head of like opening it up and like letters come flying out like in the Mexican Santa Claus movie. Like, oh, our chain mail worked. But yeah, no, this is your time, so we're not going to dilly-dally. We will read some of your emails, and we will do it toot-sweet.
Oh, indeed. This is a letter that comes from Tom, in capital letters with an exclamation point.
Hello, Tom!
Tom!
Hi, Tom!
Tom says, hello to my two favorite critics.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. Wow.
And he spells favorite with a U, so this is either from England or Canada.
Or just fancy.
Or just an American writing all fancy.
I learned how to write like sort of British spellings a lot when I was a kid, because most of like the kids' books my mom taught me to read were British.
Oh, so like Clower and
So I was like reading the original Borrowers and Dr. Doolittle and Mary Poppins and stuff, and they add a U to some stuff, so I learned that. And they were like, "This is wrong." No, it's fine.
Tom says, "I'm writing in regard to a comment I've seen on Letterboxd recently." That had me pondering a few things. I recently watched the new Soderbergh movie, Presence, which I liked but didn't love. Upon logging the film on Letterboxd, I saw a lot of reviews saying that Soderbergh is making too many movies lately. He has another one coming out very soon. That was Black Bag.
Yeah.
It came out within a couple months of Presence.
Yep.
And that these movies are not landing or sticking around in the public consciousness at all. Do prolific filmmakers run the risk of ruining their legacy by releasing very middling films on too frequent of a basis, or is a sentiment like that absolute nonsense? Do filmmakers slash artists even care or think about their legacy? Instead, are they just expressing themselves, and we should appreciate more the more we can get out of our great filmmakers? Mm. We'd love to hear your take, and also if you can think of a director that kind of lost their cred due to a run of flops. All the best. Tom!
That's a great question, actually, Tom. And one thing I can say from having interviewed a lot of filmmakers over the years, and this is actors, directors, writers, cinematographers, costume designers, the whole gamut. We, outside of that box, think about their careers very differently than most of them.
Yeah.
Like, we are looking in terms of, like, we're looking at big picture. That's not necessarily what everyone's thinking about. Some people are just thinking about, what do I, you know, if you have the luxury of being able to pick and choose your projects, what do I want to do? What's going to be good for me right now? What is good for me creatively? What will get, what will, what's a gig that will keep me closer to my kids? What's a movie I can make for my kids? Some filmmakers are concerned about their overall body of work, but generally speaking, it's so hard to get any movie made, even if you are a big filmmaker. Spielberg has trouble getting movies made.
Yeah.
You get the movie made that you can. And there are some filmmakers who just like working.
Mm-hmm.
They just love working, and they work constantly. And you know, we'll we've just seen...
Take the gig in front of them and do the best they can.
Like, yeah. Here's a good example of something you're talking about. It's not a director, but it's an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Caine.
Okay.
Michael Caine was a huge star in the 60s and 70s. And then in the 80s, he became a joke because he basically said yes to everything. And he's admitted to this.
Yeah, he said so in an Oscar thank you speech.
Yeah, basically, if you give me a gig, I will take it if I'm free. Mm. Because he was always worried he was never going to work again, or just he wanted to make money or whatever. He said he did Jaws the Revenge so he could buy a garage or something, or a boathouse.
Isn't the joke like, I haven't seen Jaws the Revenge, but I saw the garage it built or whatever it was?
Something like that, yeah, yeah. Again, some people are just doing this because it's a job.
Hmm.
And not every gig is a passion project. But Michael Caine lost a lot of credibility over the years because he did seem to just show up in anything, whether or not it was good. And then he got it back because he happened to be in good stuff. What I find, generally speaking, is that when you look at very prolific filmmakers, give it enough distance, people don't remember the chaff. They remember the wheat.
Uh-huh.
You know, like in the moment, it feels like, ugh, do we really need Intolerable Cruelty from the Coens right now?
Well,
but in the grand scheme of things, we remember the good stuff.
Yeah, when it comes to like prestige, that's not something directors choose for themselves.
Not often.
Sometimes they try. They want to only do prestige projects. Quentin Tarantino has famously said he only wants to do a finite number of films, and he's very, very picky about the kind of films he's making. Meanwhile, you look at filmmakers like Stephen Frears, and they're just doing whatever. You know, it doesn't...
Cranking them out.
Stephen Frears doesn't care. He just wants to make a movie and just shoot it the best way he can. He doesn't even have, like, a signature style.
Who directed Ichi the Killer?
Takashi Miike.
Takashi Miike has
made over 100 movies.
Yeah, he's directed over 100 feature films.
That's not exaggeration. Over 100.
And he's not 100, by the way. Like, he just churns them out, and... Yeah, a lot of them are movies you'll never hear of or that don't do great. But when he makes a good one, you fucking hear about it. And yeah. I was in film school and had a professor who was teaching us camera work.
Mm.
And he said there are two ways to do this class. One is you agonize over every shot trying to make it perfect.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll succeed. And two is shoot as much as you can. And he recommended the second one. Because you'll get more experience that way.
Yeah.
You'll learn more of what's practical. You'll learn more of, like, how to do things quickly.
Mm.
You know, you'll make mistakes along the way, but you'll learn from those mistakes faster than if you try never to make any mistakes. Think about all the prolific filmmakers. Hitchcock was incredibly prolific.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout his entire career.
How many? He made, like, 40-some movies? He made a lot.
Oh, yeah. I think more than that if you consider, like, his silent era stuff. Like, he did an astounding number of films. Most of them pretty good. Like, there aren't a lot of duds.
But there's, like, a heyday. There's the big ones people remember versus a lot of those early silent films, which fewer people have seen.
Yeah. There is also the possibility that, you know, you don't make a lot of films, and then if one of them is a dud, it's that much worse.
Yeah. That's the case with the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
The Coen brothers became awards darlings. They were really well-respected by sort of the art house community, as it were. And then they made, like, three duds in a row. Because there was Intolerable Cruelty, The Lady Killers, and The Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah.
Not in that order. And those three films were mostly critically panned. They weren't
Coen
as big
For Coen Brothers
hits.
Standards,
yeah.
They're not particularly good. I think Man Who Wasn't There is better than the other two. It's certainly beautiful to look at.
Yeah, great photography on
but,
that one.
But, yeah, no. Like, there was a time when it seemed like No Country for Old Men was out. It's like, I don't know, man. I'm thinking about giving up on the Coens.
Mm, yeah, three in a row that nobody liked. That seemed like they had lost their mojo.
Yeah.
It was nice to see when David Gordon Green came back. Because he was doing, like, big commercial comedies out of nowhere. Like,
yeah.
He started with these really... very moody, incredibly emotional, very, very good independent films. Films like Undertow and All the Real Girls. Mm-hmm. And
Snow Angels.
Snow Angels is fantastic. And then he's also doing films like Your Highness and The Sitter and Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
And
like, I like Pineapple Express.
That one's all right. It was just way out of character for him.
It was an odd shift that we knew about him so far. Yeah, it was an odd shift.
And now he's done like Halloween sequels. It's like, yeah. And Exorcist sequels. It's
yeah, he did do that, didn't he? Yeah. I chose to forget about that for a while.
Exorcist Believer. Yeah, I was going to do three of them, but that first one tanked so hard that he gave up.
I'm fine with that, honestly. Anyway, so to answer your question, generally speaking, in my experience, people who don't make movies and are fans of various artists and filmmakers tend to look at their careers in a different perspective than they do. It's very different to be the one making it than it is to be the one looking at someone saying, look at all they did. And when it comes to being a prolific filmmaker, there are multiple schools of thought on this. You know, Hitchcock made dozens. Kubrick only made like 13. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of maybe the first two, they're all bangers. But every filmmaker is different. And generally speaking, I would prefer having more films than fewer.
Yeah.
If I had to pick.
I think there's a tradition in Hollywood, especially if you go back to from the 30s all the way through the 50s, there were a lot of these kind of workman-like directors who would make a couple dozen films in a year.
Yeah.
They would just go to the studio backlot, shoot a Western in a couple of days, you know, have it edited and just throw it up in theaters. Were some of these good? Maybe. Sometimes it worked.
Sometimes they're good.
Often it was just, you know, to fill the studio coffers. I think there's a lot of integrity to that, to just sort of shooting and throwing it up without a lot of attention to how the craft is going to be regarded by posterity.
You know, I remember when I was in film school and I was still toying with the idea of being a filmmaker. And everyone was like, what kind of movies do you want to make? And I said, I want to make Sci-Fi Channel originals. And they were like, why? Because you're always working. I can make a movie about a velociraptor in Hawaii in 1 week, and then next week, something about a man eating potato bug. Like, I'm in. Like, I'm working. It's a wonderful thing to do. I admire that. I think that's a great thing. But, again, different schools of thought. It's all a matter of perspective.
Yeah.
All right, what we got next?
Here we have a letter from Chris R. Hello, Chris R. It says, hello, Luca and a refrigerator. We've had to record close to William's refrigerator a couple of times.
A lot of times.
If you've heard it humming in the background, I think we can hear it better than you can, but it bothers us.
Fun fact, we are actually recording in a hotel room right now. We didn't actually bring a great setup with us, so our microphone is perched precariously on a stool on top of a chair. This is the best we can do right now. Things are weird.
But yeah, we get it to you. We're doing what we can.
We're doing what we can right now. Anyway, we're holed up in a hotel.
So yeah, if it sounds a little different, that would be why. Anyway, hello, Luca and Refrigerator. Making this list was an agonizing but very fun exercise. For context, I'm 25 years old. I'll try to steer clear of movies you've already mentioned. This is a best movies of the century so far. The list is in no order except for my number one.
Okay.
I'll try to keep... That's how we do our
list.
That's how we do. I try to keep my comments on these brief so the letter doesn't become too daunting of a read. Anyway, the list. Best movies of the century so far. That is from the year 2000.
And we did an episode about this about a month and a half ago, maybe two months ago, if you want to listen to our take on it.
That was back in like February, I think.
And already there are things I regret about that list, and I was like, I should have put that on there. I should have put something else.
You know what?
The nature of the beast.
The list changes day by day. Paranormal Activity 1 through 3. I'm a sucker for found footage, and gosh, the first three movies of this are so quietly unnerving. Also wanted to shout out Screen Life. I adored Unfriended, but the sequel... I adore the first Unfriended, but the sequel and Searching are good as well. I never saw the Unfriended movies.
I was really annoyed by the first Unfriended, because I saw the first Unfriended and I really liked it. And I saw it at a film festival. And it was just before the movie came out, and I confirmed, like, hey, listen, this is the final version, right? And they're like, yeah, no, it's fine. So I reviewed the movie, and I gave it a very positive review, and then I found out that a couple weeks later it came out with a different ending.
And I
would not have given it a great review with that ending. I would have said I don't like the ending, and that really pissed me off. So, but generally speaking, I think these are interesting films that couldn't exist 50 years ago.
Comment on the modern state of media.
Yeah, I think Paranormal Activity 1 and 3 are particularly good. I think Searching is fucking phenomenal.
Searching is great.
Yeah. So, no, it's interesting choices. Yeah.
Wendy and Lucy from 2008. Kelly Reichardt is my favorite living filmmaker, so you can practically swap this choice out with anything else she's made this century. Whenever someone mentions the famous Ebert quote about movies being machines that generate empathy, Wendy and Lucy immediately comes to mind for me. I'm fond of First Cow.
First Cow's really good. Yeah. I need to catch up on more Kelly Reichardt films. There's a few I haven't seen, and Wendy and Lucy is actually one of them. I love Certain Women. I think that's my favorite.
Dogville, 2003. In an almost 180 degree from my previous pick, this one really explores how the veil of empathy can be weaponized to inflict abject cruelty. Mm-hmm. It's a really damning exploration of humanity in almost an Old Testament kind of a way. Yeah, Lars von Trier doesn't think much of empathy or
people
or Christianity or humanity in general.
I think he thinks very highly of specific humans and not of anyone else.
Yeah, not of humans as a group.
Yeah, I think if you're not a martyr, you're an asshole, basically in his worldview. Yeah.
Homecoming, a film by Beyoncé from 2019.
Oh.
Simply put, the best concert film I've ever seen. This would be on the list of the sheer spectacle of performance alone, but there's also a series of video essays here that manage to cover so much on a micro and macro level that is becoming the defining. It has become the defining text of a generation.
Wow.
If you missed Beychella around certain people, they can tell you exactly where they were when it happened. Beyoncé, she's a singer, right?
Yeah, no, she sang that one song.
She sang that Ring On It song, which I hate.
You hate that song?
With abject passion, I hate it's that a, song.
Wait, hold on a second. I'm confused for a second. Are you telling me, Whitney, that you have never liked a person so much that you, quote unquote, put a ring on it? Because I'm pretty sure you're married. That's a song for anyone who's married. So you're rejecting marriage.
I put a ring on it. I just didn't need to hear Beyoncé say it 50 times.
She had a robot arm.
Did she?
For you. Yeah.
Beyoncé has a robot arm?
And the music video for that. It's a dance video with like her and I think like two other dancers, black and white. But for no reason that I can determine, one of her arms is a robot arm.
Is it a ring-producing robot arm?
It should be, but
She folds her wrist open and rings pop out?
I mean, that would be cool, but I think that's in the special features.
That's in the extended cut.
Yeah. Anyway.
It adds to the lore. Let's see what else we got here. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. This one manages to strike a balance of being absolutely harrowing and completely humane. Happening and Never Really, Sometimes Always are also excellent dramas about familiar subject matter. I really liked Never Really, Sometimes Always.
Yeah, Happening was the one that wrecked me, I think.
It's the British film.
British or French?
Oh, no, you're right, it's French.
French, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm not crazy. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Happening was like 2021, just a couple years ago. That was a really good one.
No, very, very, very penetrating film.
Another one, Finding Nemo.
Hey!
That initial run of Pixar movies are pretty unassailable, but this is still the crown jewel for me. Inside Out also deserves a mention.
Yeah. I maintain that Finding Nemo is... There are maybe other Pixar movies I like better. I think Finding Nemo is their best script. I think
they got some pretty good scripts.
They do. I think everything about Finding Nemo works. I think they really make the most out of the concept. I think they beautifully realize it. It gets me every time. When I was writing for Crave and I was reviewing movies, I gave, I think, 3 10 out of 10s my entire time there. And one of them was for the re-release of Finding Nemo. Because I just think it's just perfect.
Finding Nemo, however, doesn't have that one moment where I just sort of ugly cry. A lot of the Pixar movies do, where there's just like one little bit. It's like, like it just hits you right in the chest.
Right.
I can't think of that moment in Finding Nemo.
I mean, maybe if we'd spent a little bit more time with Marlon and I forget if his wife had a name before she died.
Oh, okay.
Like, you could have totally gone to full Up territory if you'd just gotten to know those two fish a little bit more before I think it was like a barracuda got to them or something.
Up is a fantastic short followed by a movie we don't need. It's like
no one talks about the rest of that film. I actually like the rest of that movie, but it peaks real early.
It peaks really early.
Like, and if it wasn't for that opening, I think we'd think very fondly of the rest of it.
Remember
the
talking dogs and the old man and the Zeppelin?
I love that. I think that's really, really fun. But man, it just... Ugh. There was an episode of Game Changer that was called, I think, Don't Cry.
Oh.
Where the whole thing is, if you cried, you lost points. So they were like, chop an onion. Here's like a video message from your mom. And then there was one bit where it's like, okay, I'm going to give everyone a laptop and some headphones, and you're going to watch the first 5 minutes of Up.
Can you not? You're going to cry.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a pretty sad moment today. I was writing about, it's a weird thing to cry about. I was watching the music video for Metallica's One.
No, I get it.
Which is inspired by Dalton Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun.
Well, not inspired by it, just uses the footage.
Yeah, well, and then they made the music video, and they just they took the 1971 film version, which it's the only film Dalton Trumbo ever directed.
Yeah,
and
it's bleak.
And it's really bleak. The story, it's about a soldier who fought in World War One. A shell went off and completely destroyed his body, but left him alive.
Yeah, he lost his arms, his legs, and his face. He cannot see, he cannot hear, he cannot speak, and he cannot move.
Yeah.
But he's alive and conscious. Mm. And it's a lot of it's just in his head.
Mm. The whole story.
Being horrified.
Yeah.
And that was basically intercut with Metallica singing their song. Mm. MTV used to have trouble segueing to that. and now for something completely different.
Well, I was looking for other music videos that were hot that same year that came out in 1989.
Yeah.
There was every reason to be every chance that you'd be watching MTV at that time, you'd watch One, which is just ripping your heart out. This, like, really horrifying anti-war story.
Mm.
And then they would cut immediately to Love Shack by the B-52s.
Yeah.
Like, that was also big that year.
I tell you, man, Whiplash, it was wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, Finding Nemo, pretty good.
Pretty good, yeah.
Next up is Evangelion.
Evangelion.
Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0 Thrice Upon a Time. An excellent conclusion to a series that had two excellent conclusions prior to this. Hideaki Anno is one of our most imaginative working filmmakers. Mm-hmm. His series of Shin movies have all been varying levels of great, too. I really love Shin Godzilla.
Shin Godzilla's
great. I really
great.
Love Shin Ultraman.
You finally got around to it.
I finally got around
fucking
to Shin
great,
Ultraman.
Right?
Yeah.
Shin Kamen Rider is okay, but the other two are fucking brilliant. I saw the original Evangelion in its entirety over the course of a weekend, which I do not recommend. It is one of the hardest hitting. This is, you've never seen Evangelion, have you?
No.
It is a giant robot fighting monster anime that is all just about clinical depression. And it is brutal. It is seriously, I have been as low as I've ever been because I watched the original Evangelion and I paid attention. And then they started like remaking them and like, because apparently they were never really happy with the original ending. They ran out of money and there was a whole thing. But like, I've fallen behind on these like updates or whatever. I hear they're really good. I'll bet they are. But
Anyway, next up is Black Swan. This one is here for more sentimental reasons. This, along with District 9, unlocked what cinema could be to a young, impressionable me.
We all have a movie that broke our brain at just the right time.
Not the most sophisticated movies, but the kind that lit the spark to me becoming a cinephile, and I have to credit that.
It's a movie you cannot argue.
Yeah.
Like, no, this was like your cinematic egg crack.
Yeah.
Like, you're watching fun movies, watching fun movies, watching fun movies, David Lynch's Lost Highway. Oh, I didn't know movies could do that.
Wait, this is allowed?
Yeah. No, that was my movie. That was like holy shit.
That started happening with me when I was around 16 or so. I sort of saw some movies. Like, wait a minute. Cinema is different.
Yeah.
That was really fantastic. Next up is Apocalypto from 2006. There are some very valid critiques against it, and the director is persona non grata, so I respect why people bristle away at this one. I just don't think Hollywood has managed to produce an action picture this pulse-pounding in the years since it has been released.
I mean, here's the thing. Mel Gibson sucks.
Yeah.
He absolutely sucks. That doesn't mean he's never had any...
As a human being, unfortunately, he's a talented filmmaker.
That doesn't mean he never had any talent, but the problem is sometimes that talent is in service of bad things, and there's a lot of genuine critiques over the portrayal of things in Apocalypto, but just in terms of a chase scene, you know, he knows how to film it, which is frustrating because, you know, it's easier to write them off if they don't have any talent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
And the number one, the best film of the century so far is Under the Skin. This achieves everything I can want from a movie. The gamut of emotions. This puts me through makes me physically exhausted every time I watch it. Yes, I can't stay away from it. Honorable mentions, Certified Copy. I like Certified Copy. The Clouds of Sils Maria, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy, Love Lies Bleeding, that's a good choice. The Handmaiden, In My Skin. Ooh, nobody talks about In My Skin.
Is that the Banderas one?
No, that's Marina Devan. She's a woman who becomes a... It's a kind of a horror
Oh, is that the one where she brings... Movie? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Okay, sorry,
Babylon. Thank you, Justice for Babylon. Orphan, any Satoshi Kon movie.
Yes.
I Am Not a Witch. That's a great choice.
Great choice.
Hero. I'm guessing that's the...
I assume it's a Jet Li
film. Jet Li movie.
Yeah, I don't think there's another prominent... There was another Wuxia film called Hero that came out... late 90s, maybe very early 2000s, but I'd be surprised if that's the one that you're referring to. And then, of course, there's the Andy Garcia, Dustin Hoffman movie, but that was the early 90s.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I assume you're talking about the very pretty Jet Li movie.
There's Bridesmaids and Drive My Car and a million others, but I need to stop naming movies at this point. Thanks for reading this. I hope it wasn't too long. Now it's time for me to immediately regret my whole list. Signed, Chris R.
Hey, I already regret mine. Thank you so much. And again... people are free to send us in their lists. We are very curious to hear about them. So, thank you very much. Yeah. What do you got next?
Let's see. What do we have? This is from
the story
Brian.
Of a girl. Oh, sorry.
This is a story of Brian.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Or rather, underscore lowercase b Brian. So
okay,
we got handles, man. We got names, but no names, man. No names.
How do you pronounce an underscore? Like a like a glottal stop? Like
I'm not sure.
Okay.
it's like an ellipsis, but not quite as long a beat.
You know, when we had, like, everyone always, like, got excited to, like, you know, what if I were an X-Man? What would my cool name be? Mm. And then everyone got a chance to do that on the internet, and all the cool names were taken immediately. Mm. So I feel like nowadays, if a superhero came along, it's like, yeah, I want to be Hawkeye. Oh, that's taken. That's okay. Mine is spelled with all lowercase letters and an umlaut.
Small s, small n, big d, small e.
And it's like surrounded by like X's on both sides and underscores, so it's fine.
I'm startled by some of the names. Like my son just turned 10 years old.
Yeah.
And he's big on the YouTube celebrity channel. He doesn't even like movies. He just likes the YouTube celebrities. And he, some of the names those people choose that just sort of catch on are completely random. He's very fond of a YouTuber named Sundee, S-S-U-N-D-E-E. Why that? Who knows? I don't know why he chose it, why he decided to make that his handle, if that's what he chose before he got famous and he just had to stick with it.
That happens sometimes. Yeah. That happens sometimes. Yeah, I don't know. Got baffling. But again, if they were X-Men, that's your X-Men name now. Boom. Congratulations.
Anyway, Brian has another list of the best films of the century so far. Bibbs and McCool, there are two topics I wanted to bring up, so I'll do my best to be concise. First up, I wanted to share my top 10 of the century so far, and this is just a rundown.
Okay.
Honorable mentions, the movies that might have made my list, but you already recommended. The Master, Gravity. I would also include Roma, another one of Kwan's best.
Fair enough.
The Witch and The Lighthouse, and tied for number 8. Eggers' Nosferatu might join these two in time, but I want to rewatch it to see if it holds up. Number 7, Creed.
Yes! Love Creed.
Number 6, a tie between The Social Network and Zodiac.
Cool.
Number 5, City of God. Good choice. Okay. Number 4, An Elephant Sitting Still. Thank you for saying that.
How many people saw that movie just because...
just because I wouldn't shut up
about it. I'm willing to bet it's a not inconsiderable number.
Number 3, The Turin Horse.
Oh, wow.
That's a good choice. Number 2, A Tie Between the Tree of Life and A Hidden Life. Both excellent.
That's a great choice. Great,
number,
good life movies.
Number 1, No Country for Old Men. And now here's my top 10.
Okay.
I sense a personal restriction, one filmmaker per...
You can't have a whole bunch of Soderbergh or whatever. Yeah, got it.
Number 10, following your lead, my number 10 is the Just For Me pick, Zack Snyder's Justice League.
All right.
As a filmmaker, Snyder makes everything epic in a film about superheroes, that fits. That's a 4-hour cut.
I mostly like that cut, to be fair. I don't think you need the dream sequence at the end. I think that takes it down. There's a couple of bit of wonky bits, and I think the first hour could definitely use a trim. But generally speaking, that's really good, actually. I like a lot of that movie.
I find it strange that we had this theatrical cut and everybody got all up in their own heads about how it was a different filmmaker. Joss Whedon directed a lot of it, even though he's not a credited director. He rewrote a lot of it, and they upped the color and they changed everything. and it kind of tanked. It wasn't a big hit.
Oh, yeah,
a lot of people didn't like it.
Yeah.
And so there was this big outcry, a hashtag release the Snyder Cut. There wasn't actually a cut. They had to go back and reshoot it. They spent $70 million more dollars on it.
$70 million. That's why
additional dollars.
That's why people said it would never happen, because that's a huge investment for a movie that already tanked.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for the fact that HBO Max needed content, and COVID and pandemic certainly, you know, it's like we have an epic in the can, basically. Mm. We just need to reshoot a bit. And
turns
so,
out it was a lot.
Yeah, it turns out it was a lot. I don't think under any other circumstances we ever would have seen that movie in that form.
Yeah, but after all of that came out and I watched that longer version, it's just as entertaining. They are equal.
I watched them back.
One is not better than the other.
I disagree with this. I watched them back to back just so that I could notice all the differences. The Snyder Cut is better. I'm gonna go to bat for it. You and I were two of the only people who didn't hate the theatrical cut because it has some entertainment value. It was sloppy, but we don't necessarily think that's a deal breaker. That's,
not a detriment.
Yeah. No, the Snyder Cut is remarkably better.
Okay,
I think so.
Anyway, number 9, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. That's a bit of an odd choice. This film has always felt like the outlier in David Fincher's filmography. Mm-hmm. That might be a feature, not a bug. Every time I watch it, it just works for me.
Hmm.
All right.
It's his most sentimental film, and for me, that is just odd from David Fincher. I feel like
the material doesn't match his style very well, but no.
Yeah, if it works, it works. It's fine.
Number 8, The Weeping Meadow. That's an interesting choice. Huh. Theo Angelopoulos epic, set in Greece during the upheaval between World War I and World War II. I didn't see The Weeping Meadow.
Neither did I. That's amazing. I've
heard very many positive things about it.
Best of the century. Holy shit.
Number 7, Zero Dark Thirty. I prefer Zero Dark Thirty to The Hurt Locker, despite the historical inaccuracies. Catherine Bigelow directs one of the most intense scenes in modern cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Number 6, 12 Years a Slave.
Yep.
Steve McQueen's film, based on the harrowing life of Solomon Northrup in Antebellum South. Number 5, Pan's Labyrinth, Guillermo del Toro's dark great fairy film. Tale set against a war in Spain, visually singular and emotionally poignant. Number 4, The Handmaiden.
Yes.
Park Chan-wook's take on the Fingersmith, taking it from the British period piece to Korean period piece.
With countless twists
and turns that all work.
I really want for people to see The Handmaiden. We do not talk about it enough. It came out, it was celebrated a bit.
Oh, yeah. Critics loved it.
Didn't win a lot of awards.
I
loved it too. And I just feel like it's one of those movies that nobody talks about. And then when it comes up, everyone goes, yeah, that movie fucking kicks ass. Why does no one talk about that more? We need to start talking about it more.
Yeah.
So because it's amazing.
Number 3 is Moonlight.
Yeah.
Barry Jenkins' incredible coming of age story, a young gay black man set in Miami. Number 2, There Will Be Blood.
Yes,
great. Paul Thomas Anderson's American story of greed and power and the lives of Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Plainview will destroy to get them. P.T. Anderson did a couple films that he sees as the spirit of America. There was There Will Be Blood and there was The Master.
Mm-hmm.
And they're weirdly succinct in capturing the character of the United States.
There was a meme going around a few years ago that was blank movie if it came out in 2007.
Mm.
And it was always the end of the movie to the tune of Linkin Park.
Oh,
Linkin
Park's What I've Done. And that kind of...
I did two of those I'm very proud of. And when I obliterated my Twitter account, I lost them. And I regret losing them, but I still think I made the right choice. One was the last shot in The Third Man
with the zither music.
Yeah, well, it's just Valley walking slowly towards the camera for 3 minutes.
Right,
perfect. But my best one I did was There Will Be Blood if it came out in 2007.
It did
exactly. But let me tell you something. Linkin Park teams up actually syncs up perfectly with that scene. I'm finished. What I've done. Erased myself. Well played, Linkin Park.
And the number one, Brian's favorite film of the last 25 years is The Prestige.
Ha! Good pick.
That's a startling pick. Christopher Nolan makes the kind of films I love to watch, and I still think The Prestige is his best film. Released the same year as The Illusionist, and between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, I think it's easy to overlook, but for me, it edges out Oppenheimer, Tenet, Dunkirk, Interstellar, The Dark Knight Trilogy, and Memento as my favorite.
That's a hell of a film, honestly. It is great.
Oh, what? Not Following? P.S. I've added Master and Commander to my watch list to revisit after your discussion about
it. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let us know what you think.
Yeah. Oh, The Prestige. Wow, interesting.
I actually do think that's a great film, and I think it's one of Nolan's better films.
I think it's Nolan's most sort of warmest, most personable movie. It's about characters that are actually like kind of fun to be around. Most of his characters are kind of stuffed shirts. And that's by design. Those are the kinds of characters he likes to write.
The movie I need to rewatch is Interstellar. Because I saw it and I was, you know, obviously I'm dazzled by the scale of it and some of the visual effects and all that kind of stuff. But I found these emotional beats that everyone like fawns over now to be feel really insincere.
Yeah.
And yet everyone still talks about them to this day. It's been over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, yeah, I should just sit down and rewatch that just in case I miss something. Because it happens.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'm a different person now. And I'll see something I didn't see before.
I went back to Interstellar and I liked it less. So oh, dear. It's, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, noted. It's always a risk.
I wasn't super impressed the first time. I watched it again. It's like, you guys, this is even cornier the second time. Part two, the second part. That was only the first part of the letter.
Oh, shoot.
Speaking of my watch list, the movie that has been on the longest is called Fairyland. It premiered at Sundance 2 years ago, winning some awards and getting strong reviews. But I've heard nothing of it since, and it seems to be completely unavailable. I'm not going to ask what happened to this specific movie, but what happens to this type of movie? They premiered at festivals and then completely disappear. I may be wrong, but I would think that some streamer or distributor would want this kind of film, or do the producers just sit on it and wait to get a certain offer, or do they write it off like WB has done with some recent projects? Any insight would be appreciated. They are on Ovid.
Not all of them.
Ovid is pretty good about picking up those festival darlings that don't get wide distribution. They might finally get released and will only play in like a museum, but like you can't make it to a 2:30 p.m. screening on a Wednesday at LACMA. So those kinds of movies you'll find on Ovid, a streaming service I'm very fond of. That's a flippant answer, of course. What happens to them is they do get distributed, but by the time they hit theaters, all of the reviews have been written. A lot of the critics review them out of the film festival circuit, and then when they finally reach a mainstream audience, there's no hype for them.
Yeah, the buzz is gone. That's part of it.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Yeah. That happened with a movie, one of my favorite movies of a couple of years ago, is called House of Hummingbird. It's a Korean film.
Oh, yeah.
It's a coming-of-age story about a teenage girl growing up in Korea in the 1990s. Mm. And it was a fantastic drama about this young girl who had this really horrible home life and the teacher who kind of showed her a little bit of understanding and how she actually had this like very passionate inner life. It was a fantastic movie. And it was reviewed when it came out, like barely reviewed when it came out of the festival circuit. And then when it finally hit audiences, that was it. It already got its coverage.
Yeah.
So I think that happens to a lot of them.
They get
reviewed, they do get distribution, but you rarely hear about it.
Well, and sometimes what happens is a movie will do well at a festival, but the people who buy these movies to distribute them are saying to themselves, can we make money on that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is not necessarily. And so the moment has passed for them to build that hype train, and then all of a sudden, you're the movie everyone passed on. Mm. Now, often these movies do come out. I was actually just thinking of a film that I reviewed way back in 2019, a film called Giants Being Lonely.
Ooh.
Not a great title, kind of awkward, but basically, what if Terrence Malick directed Everybody Wants Some and there's a dark twist?
Okay.
And that's a hell of a pitch, honestly. And I liked it, actually, so like quite a bit.
Loving close-up of people running their hands through, like, like a dugout's chain link
Lots
fence.
Of cameras floating behind people as they walk home in a rural setting from baseball games that everyone loves them for because they're the local boys.
I love it already.
Yeah, I liked it, actually. Mm. And I thought it was, maybe it's not going to, you know, set the world on fire, but I thought it would do okay. And years went by, and it just never came out. And then, just because you mentioned this, that my first thought was, Giants Being Lonely. It's on Tubi. It became content. It just, finally someone, I guess, said, listen, we got to do something with it.
Yeah.
And so they put it out very unceremoniously. It is available to watch. That's probably what's going to happen to most festival films that don't go anywhere, is that eventually they'll end up somewhere. But sometimes they don't. And if you look back over the history of Sundance, you look at all the films that have played at Sundance over the years, not all of them got distribution. Some of them are just in someone's closet somewhere.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a bummer. It's a real bummer. So I wish I had better news about that. But
yeah. I'm going to share with you a resource that for some reason is not widely known, but go to justwatch.com.
Yeah.
So just go to Just Watch. They actually will point to you to whatever streaming service a film may be playing on.
Yeah, just look at the title. They'll tell you everything. And Letterboxd kind of does the same thing, but I think I like the way Just Watch does it a little bit better. It's a little cleaner of a search for me. Yeah, basically. So I was like, oh, I'll never see Giants Being Lonely. Just Watch. I literally just look at Just Watch. Yeah, it's on Tubi because, of course, it fucking is.
So, yeah, go to Just Watch. Maybe the films you're looking for are there. All those those festival darlings.
And just check back in every once in a while. Just check back in every once in a while because, you know, someday it'll just pop up. And you'll never know.
Streaming is so capricious. I really do. I know not everybody has the money to do so, but if you can collect a physical copy on Blu-ray or even DVD of a movie you love, do it. Get it. Have it. Do you have a player? Not right now. Keep it anyway.
There
have
may something be a day aside. When you're the only person who has it.
Yeah. It's important to keep those things kind of around. I was getting... I, like a lot of collectors, was very zealous with my collecting for a while. Mm-hmm. I was just accumulating DVDs. Like, I would go to video stores and get their overflow stock. And I realized I had started buying films that I didn't like that much, or like just my shelves were getting full.
Yeah.
So I did a great culling. I ended up getting rid of a lot of those, and I got very, very selective about what I was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've come back around again to, if I like it and I want it, I'm going to buy it immediately. I knew I'm going to get it.
I moved 2 years ago, and we just didn't have space for my DVDs. We still didn't. You saw how many DVDs I got rid of. I got rid of... Yeah. Like 1,000 DVDs, probably.
And that wasn't even half your collection.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. No. And like a lot of them was stuff that I don't really need. Stuff I accumulated over the years kind of randomly. You know, why do I own 2 copies of Transformers Revenge of the Fallen? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
I regret getting rid of every single one. I'm not going to lie. I regret getting rid of every single one. I made a mistake.
It's nice to have a library of your own.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's a letter.
By the way, I sold them. Like I didn't throw them away or anything like that. Yeah. Like they're out in the ether somewhere.
Yeah. We got some video stores here in town.
If you bought a used copy of Daddy's Home 2, it might be mine.
You know what? I guarantee that's William's copy of Daddy's Home 2 because he bought the one that they sold.
Nah. Why did I have that? Anyway, moving on.
All right, here's a letter from Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Dear Bibbs and Whitney, this email has been years in the making. Over the past few months, I've been re-listening to the B-Movies podcast.
Oh, God.
For the first time in years. You have it.
That's
don't.
No.
Just what we were doing it. That's what we did at the time. But for at least the third time in total, I downloaded the episodes as they were released and kept them on my drive like prized possessions. Good thing I did, since they don't seem to be available anywhere these
days.
That's
true. They're gone.
I had them on a thumb drive, and I lost the thumb drive.
So I think I have them somewhere. But you might have the only copy of that.
Yeah, that's true. You might have the only ones.
Yeah.
I decided to write because around episode 100, released sometime in 2013, you guys went on a bit of a sentimental tangent, joking about people discovering your podcast in the distant future and wondering where you'd be then. Whitney said, if it's 10 or 15 years from now and anyone is still listening, let us know. So here I am, 12 years later.
Oh my God.
Still tuning in regularly.
Wow.
I used to listen for entertainment and insight, and now the podcast holds a historic and nostalgic significance for me as well. After that much time, geez.
That's weird.
It's fun hearing you guys discuss movie news and rumors. Some that we did a news segment on
Movies
podcast.
Our first podcast together was basically an assignment for the website we worked at. They wanted movie reviews, but we also want to talk about latest movie news.
The title, the B-Movies Podcast, we came up with in a second, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't something we put any thought
into. No. But, like, so the format was different. We were different. We were told to have a certain tone, which really wasn't us, and we abandoned it after a couple dozen episodes. Yeah. And we found our way over time. I'm not proud of all those episodes. But I'm honored that you still have them and are still listening. That's really wild.
So movie news and rumors. Some films that never saw the light of day, others that came out years later, often in completely unexpected forms. Tetris, anyone?
That's right. We joked about that.
Oh, gosh.
Remember when they were announcing a Tetris, but it wasn't going to be about the making of Tetris. Yeah. It was going to be some kind of weird dramatization of Tetris.
Of like being with it. Yeah. I remember you said Tetris the movie, and my response was, fuck you. let's see. And of course, how could I forget Bibb's hilarious porn reviews, Whitney already being weary of comic book movies way back in 2012, and the adorable adventures of Milo Multigrain. Aww.
Oh, Whitney had a comic strip once.
I still do.
Well, you know what I mean.
Like, I haven't made one in many years, yeah. But yeah, go to MiloMultigrain.com. I'm still paying for that domain.
Yeah. He made these like really adorable, very friendly comics that are basically just for kids.
Yeah, it's a comic strip for kids. It just wrote them on a whim, and it's about this little boy, Milo Multigrain. It's kind of me, but he's just by himself, and he explains things that he's excited about, but little calm things.
Like toast. Oh. Wasn't there one about toast?
There's not one about toast. There's one about him, like how he cuts a pineapple.
That's I think I was thinking of. There was some food one.
It's one about how he's going through the newspaper and like. Defacing the photographs, and then he cuts them out and puts them on a wall.
Yeah,
he sneaks into his parents' bathroom and like uses like cologne when he's not supposed to.
Yeah, not a kid.
There's a strip where he's waiting outside the library, but we don't see him go in. It's just about how he's excited about going in the library and he's just waiting for it to open. Like really calm, nothing moments. Honestly, I think are really big in my mind.
Honestly, it's a really cozy strip. I think more people should read it. I thought it was really cute.
MiloMultigrain.com is still out there. This re-listen made me realize that one of the reasons I love the films of the 2010s so much is because I got to discover them through you. Listening to your reviews, then watching those movies, sometimes the other way around, created an unusual dialogue between us, one that was incredibly rewarding for me. So thank you again for that wonderful decade, my friends. Thank you for listening.
That's so nice.
I don't want to end on a sour note, but I have to admit that in 2020, I stopped listening to critically acclaimed and never went back. I don't mean to be harsh, but at the peak of the culture war, I felt that the podcast leaned too far in one direction, making the discussions less nuanced, overly emotional, at times too preachy. Well, that's who we became, I suppose.
Yeah, fair enough.
I wasn't interested in hearing why you found this or that movie offensive, or more often than not, potentially offensive to someone, which in your eyes made it fundamentally bad or reprehensible. Coming from a predominantly Catholic and conservative country, I have an inherent aversion to hearing people judge others on moral grounds. Ah, that's fair.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
But I just, it's just not what I'm looking for in movie criticism or life in general. I'm a peaceful man. I don't enjoy drama or outrage.
I don't enjoy it either. I hate that we don't live in a world that has so much of that we have to comment on it.
And we fell into it. We became outraged by things that were outrageous.
Politics became a lot less abstract and became a lot more actually like, no, people need to be defended. People are being attacked.
Well,
and like,
also we got older and our points of view changed a lot.
That's true.
And our how we feel about certain political observations did change over time.
Yeah.
And how we express ourselves politically changed over time.
And I think, you know, when we think about, I like this movie because it's fun. That's a perfectly valid thing. But why is it fun? And if it's not fun, why isn't it fun? Mm. And if it's not fun because I think this movie is really racist, it's hard for me to have fun with that. Yeah. And I have to explain why. And, you know, and listen, if that's not something people are interested in, fair. Mm. Can't fight that. That's why there's a lot of critics out there, you know. Yeah. And again, that's not all we do, but it's really, really hard not to talk about some of these things today in particular. Yeah.
Anyway, that said, 5 years later, I'm still a passionate movie fan. I don't listen to any movie podcasts. I've tried many, but I've never found a worthy replacement for the B-Movies podcast and critically acclaimed. You guys are the best and still smarter than me. wishing you all the best in decades of successful podcasting ahead, Adam. Well, thanks for writing it. Thanks for sticking with it for so long.
Adam, that's amazing. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry we lost you, but fair enough. And we grow apart sometimes, don't we?
Well, I also understand, you know, if we don't involve, we're not good. If we don't evolve, we're not good critics. If we don't grow up, you know, then we're not growing up.
Right. We're going to change over time, as every human being does, and I think should.
Yeah.
Honestly. And we're going to turn out differently, and that's fine, too.
I can even tell, like, there are certain movies I watch that I know I would have loved if I had seen them at an earlier age.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies that I would have loved when I was 19 that I, like, hate now.
Yeah.
There's movies that I probably would have found boring and reprehensible when I was a youth, but I really adore now.
You know, and
our tastes also evolve.
No, that's I actually think that I remember when I was younger seeing a lot of like very serious movies about very serious topics, especially about being older, and I was like, This is doing nothing for me, and I know that in 20 years it's going to hit me hard.
Yeah.
And I can't review it on that terms now, but, you know, you look back now, and it's like, yeah, no, that fucking sucks. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, that's so brutal. Oh, I don't want to talk about it.
Like, I admit to liking but not loving the movie Parasite.
Sure.
The Bong Joon-ho film. I know if I had seen that in college, I would not stop talking about it for a decade. Like,
sure.
It probably would have hit a lot harder if I'd seen it when I was 20.
Yeah.
But I saw it in my mid-40s, so it didn't hit quite as hard. I just have thirsts for other things now.
Right. And again, this is why we need critics from different age groups.
Exactly.
From different experiences, different walks of life, different cultures, different everything.
And I can only argue my point of view. So if a 20-year-old sees it and says, this is the best thing ever, I'm going to say, I respect that, and here's how I feel about it, which is different. It's not to disrespect it or say that the 20-year-old is, you know, incorrect in any kind of way, because I was that 20-year-old once.
Sure.
And, you know, someday I'm going to be that 60-year-old, or I'm going to be that 80-year-old who's, you know, watching movies and having new reactions to them.
Sure.
And who's to say what my tastes will be by then? Mm. Maybe there's films I love now that I'll hate in 20, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Who can say? It is weird. It is weird to think about how long we've been doing this.
Well, yeah, we started podcasting on like an official basis in
15 years ago.
2011, I believe.
Was it 2011 or 2010?
It was 2011. The first film we did was that 3D spelunking movie.
Oh, the Cavern.
No, not the Cavern. I think it was just called like Below or something.
No, it wasn't Below. Oh, it had Richard Roxburgh in it. What the hell was that? It had a very generic name.
Yeah.
Hold on. I'm just going to look up Richard Roxburgh because that's not going to bring up too many movies. No, not Richard Chamberlain. Come on. Help me out here.
Richard Chamberlain. I would love to see a Richard Chamberlain cave movie.
Sanctum.
Sanctum. That was it.
Yeah.
That was one of the first ones we did.
It was that one. I think it was No Strings Attached. It was around the same time.
Yeah. It was like, I think we started in January, which was a rough time to start.
Yeah, it was the end of January. Yeah. Weird times. I've run into people who have told me, and I'm very flattered by this, but it is weird to hear it out loud, that they've been reading my stuff since they were a kid.
Oh, geez.
And I was like, no, you know what? That's fine. It was kind of weird to hear it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think of myself... Time doesn't work the same in your own brain.
Yeah.
But 15 years is a long fucking time. And if you're in your like mid-20s and you've only been paying attention to movies for so long, yeah, you might have encountered my shit in a formative year. Yeah, why not? That's wonderful. By all means, please tell me that. But it is weird and it will happen to you. It's not bad at all. It is odd.
Yeah.
Because it, much like we talked about, like people have different perspectives on filmmakers' career than the filmmakers. You have that perspective on my career and it's different than my perspective on my career.
Right.
You know, I don't think of it on those terms, you know? So, yeah, I can't.
I haven't had somebody tell me they've been reading my reviews like for many years. I do remember the first time reading a critic and being like really impressed. It's like this person's a really fantastic writer, and then learning that she was younger than me. Like, because I was at that time, I was still like kind of struggling. I was trying to get published, and here she is writing for the LA Weekly, and of course it was Amy Nicholson.
Oh yeah, because Amy Nicholson's a fucking genius. Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, so yeah, thanks Amy for giving me a crisis of confidence by being as good as you are.
Anyway, we should move on.
Here's a letter from Cameron.
Hello, hi, Cameron.
Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I've never written into a show before,
but
I've been a loyal listener for years, so this is literally a long-time listener, first-time caller situation.
Thank you.
I'm a little behind, so I just finished your episode of the best movies of the 21st century so far, and wanted to throw some love to two of my favorite movies, not just of this century, but in general. One conventional and the other a little non-conventional. One is Spike Jonze's Her. The tone, script, performance, and score, all pitch perfect in my opinion. All around, this movie has made a lasting impact on how I view loneliness, specifically male loneliness, and our relationships not just to technology, but also to our fellow humans. Truly one of the great and heartbreaking love stories I've seen, and one that I feel will become more representative of reality as AI continues to take shape in the coming years.
That's probably a fair point.
I'm sure you've discussed Her in depth on your show before, but I would be curious to know your thoughts and critiques on this film.
It's been a long time since we talked about Her, I think.
Yeah, Her is...
It's a great film.
It came out in 2013, and that's a pretty banging year for movies.
Yeah.
Her is really fantastic. It's really soulful and relatable, and I think, yes, a little bit prescient.
Yeah.
I think it does speak to the way that the world is getting more crowded and yet we feel more isolated. Yep. It's a film that was talking about it, you know, over a decade ago.
But the irony is that we don't reach out for each other.
No, yeah, we're looking for sort of an idealized version of a person that doesn't exist.
And yeah.
Her is kind of the fantasy, well, what if that person did exist? What would that look like? And how it does sort of cure your loneliness, but also, it's also a thing.
Yeah, it's also false.
It's this, it has no physical body, it's in a cloud.
I think I owe that one a rewatch too, come to think of it. I think it probably speaks a lot better to today than it did even then. At the time, it seemed apropos.
And Scarlett Johansson plays the voice of her. What was the name of the computer? Like
Samantha, it's like or something?
Eve or something. I forgot what it was.
Oh yeah.
But they evidently dubbed in her voice at the last minute.
Yeah, they switched it out.
It was Samantha Morton, who's a very good actress. Mm-hmm. But evidently, Spike Jonze is just like, not quite right. Yeah. It wasn't right for what I was trying to do.
No, it was Samantha. It was right.
Samantha. All right. Okay. Yeah. I feel like. It probably hit a lot harder in 2025. I think it's set in 2025, or maybe it's 2029, but it's the near future. Our relationship to technology and how technology changes the way we relate to each other is something that her was talking about before we were losing our minds on. Well, I guess we were already losing our minds on Twitter.com, but even more so.
Yeah.
Some movies about technology are proving to be weirdly prescient in a post-COVID world. Because COVID just accelerated a lot of bad tech habits.
That's true.
A lot of the way streaming operated, the way films were kind of deteriorating. In popularity, that is. Not in quality.
Yeah.
Anyway, next... back to the letter here. Next, on the opposite end of the spectrum, I wanted to highlight 2001's Josie and the Pussycats. As silly as that may sound, I do believe this movie is better than it has any right to be. I was deeply misunderstood upon its release. It's my one go-to examples of what I showed to my younger coworkers what a new millennium but pre-9/11 looked like for a brief moment. The soundtrack is truly great. The performances are all camp. Shout out to Alan Cumming and Parker Posey. In my world, they should have had Oscars for those roles. And this movie is just an earnest, loving, and playful spirit that I don't see in too many films today, and quite frankly, I miss. Josie and the Pussycats has earned a cult following in the later years, but I still feel like it's largely unseen and not discussed as much as I feel it should be. This is one of those "is it greater where you eat" situation. That's a phrase coined by Alonso Duralde.
Right.
But I truly love this movie. For what this movie is, it's the best version of that. And it was at least commenting on what our capitalistic consumer culture was like in the late 90s and early 2000s. When at the bare minimum, all that was asked was just to be product IP slop. It feels impossible to imagine a studio film being made today that would even dare to step into that territory. Anyway, thanks for reading my letter. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts. I enjoy shows, reviews, mailbags, all of it. Hope you two are doing well. Cameron,
thank you so much. I have never seen Josie and the Pussycats, and I have attempted to rectify this.
Okay.
Multiple times, and it just never quite works out, or like the article I'm writing to which it would have been very relevant... ends up not getting picked up, and so I don't have the time to prioritize it. And everyone I know whose opinion matters to me agrees with you that it is a great, capital G, great movie. So, probably right. There will come a day when it is on the Criterion Collection, and only then...
Well, you finally get around to it.
Well, no. I think only then will people finally just admit. Because again, some movies are instant classics. Everyone loves them right off the bat. Some movies find their audience over time. But there has to come a point, eventually, where they go from cult classic to bona fide classic. Mm-hmm. Where it's not just a small group of people who love it a lot. It's everyone appreciates how great it is.
Yeah.
And we're not there with Josie and the Pussycats yet. But I do believe it's going to take some brave soul putting it on the Criterion Collection, making a night of it on Turner Classic Movies. Something. Someone's got to actually step up and give it a platform.
I feel like Josie and the Pussycats, I feel like, is a film that has been rescued. There are certain films that are not huge hits when they come out, or they're only modestly successful. And within the years that follow, sort of a very passionate following begins to rally around it. Sometimes those movies stay obscure.
Yeah.
Only the passionate followers, like a very small group of them, are the ones talking about it. Sometimes they do get rescued, and they start actually getting re-releases on home video and retrospectives, articles in Vulture.
Sure.
And then live appearances at midnight movies. They get rescued. People do start to appreciate those movies, and I feel like Josie and the Pussycats is one of those. There have been all of those things about Josie and the Pussycats. It's not obscure anymore.
I don't know about obscure. My point is, when will it achieve bona fide classic status as opposed to midnight movie status?
I feel like it was touching on a lot of anti-commercial sort of sentiment that was floating through a lot of media in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Sort of anti-commercial stuff was pretty big.
Selling out was considered a bad thing.
Yeah.
There's
that whole sequence in Wayne's World
where
they're... they say they don't want to sell out while they're like clearly holding like Pizza Hut products and eating Doritos and like smiling when they eat them. It's like people only do things because they get paid, and it's just really sad. He's relaxing. He's wearing all Reebok product.
Yeah.
That was Josie and the Pussycats was actually tapping into something that was already kind of a big part of 1990s media.
Yeah.
It just did it in kind of a very bubbly, friendly kind of a way.
Right, and it's easy to write that off.
Yeah.
Because serious things have serious tones.
And that was almost a slapstick farce. There's a scene near the beginning where a bunch of characters are in a plane crash, is played for laughs. And we get to see them later in like full body casts, like they're in a cartoon, that kind of stuff.
Got it.
And that's kind of hard for a lot of critics to just say, oh, this is clearly some sort of commentary on modern music slop.
It can be hard for some critics to want to put their reputations on the line for a film that's clearly silly.
I'll say this, the soundtrack is really good.
Isn't it canonically connected to Can't Hardly Wait? Isn't like the band from Can't Hardly Wait in the movie?
Oh, I don't know. I've never seen Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure there's like...
Du Jour was the boy band from Josie and the
Pussycats. No, it wasn't a boy band. It was like a garage band. It was like called like Love Burger or something like that.
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember that. Anyway, more?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's a letter from Jesse. Hello, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I'm a big fan of the first Halloween movie.
Yes.
John Carpenter's style always spoke to me both in directing and writing, and I find that first movie endlessly rewatchable. Now, 12 movies later, I feel like Halloween is in a weird spot. It's been so endlessly knocked off to the point that it feels like the only thing setting apart the new Halloweens from the knockoffs is that Michael Myers is in the new ones.
Mm.
But without the story of Halloween, is Michael Myers even the same character? Getting a little existential here.
Yeah.
It feels like the franchise is stuck between a rock and a hard place. Change the story and rely on the Halloween name to differentiate itself from the knockoff. Or keep the story and risk feeling like a rehash of 13 other movies.
Right.
So is there a way forward for the Halloween franchise?
Mm.
Is there some angle that I'm missing out on here? Or should we let Sleeping Dogs lie and let the knockoffs carry on Halloween's legacy? I'd love to hear what you both think in terms of what would make the best / most interesting movies, and if there's some plan you think the studios would actually go for. Love the shows. Jesse.
This is a great question. Halloween is actually an interesting example of a franchise, because if you look at the original movie... Unless you can look at the ending as sequel bait, but it was never intended to be.
No.
It was supposed to be sort of abstract.
Just the evil is still out.
And if you only watch John Carpenter's original Halloween, it's a perfect standalone movie. It's a fantastic movie. It's one of the great horror movies. We cannot pretend that the sequels and remakes don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It is now more than just that first film. It is this huge franchise. It is everything that it has ever been, good and bad. But what's interesting about these horror movie franchises is that every single time a new film comes out, with a few occasional exceptions where they're very popular, there's always people who say this sucks. Like, oh my God, I can't believe Jason went to Manhattan, but only in the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Oh.
I hate this movie. Ignoring the fact that it's actually really entertaining. It's just kind of a cop-out of the title. You know? Everyone hated Jason Goes to Hell the Final Friday. Now it's got a cult following because it's really, really fun and weird. And we've just... we grow to accept what we have, for better and worse. So every Halloween movie has been an attempt, I think, to make a good or at the very least entertaining Halloween movie. And they're, you're right, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You change it up too much and people complain. You don't change it enough and people complain. What do you do? Do whatever. That's my response to you. Yeah, you're going to try doing some weird shit. It's not going to work. Sometimes it will, but sometimes it won't. And then after you've tried being weird, go back to basics just for one film. Just remind people, this is what you like. This is what we all like. Now, psychic vampires. Let's do it. Let's throw some in there. You know, like.
Well, this goes back to what we were talking about filmmakers' legacy. Yeah. Now, some filmmakers are actually try to be conscious of their own legacy as artists, whereas others don't care and they just charge ahead.
Yeah, some care very deeply about the legacy of a franchise that they enter.
I can assure you 100% that most of the makers of slasher movies in the 70s and 80s didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
They were doing a job.
Yeah.
Maybe they liked violence and gore, maybe they liked horror movies, but they didn't have any idea that this was going to be considered a legacy. This was commercial trash.
These things were cranked out. Here's a tiny budget. Mm. We don't fucking care. Yeah. We don't fucking care. Just put the bad guy in it. Kill some people in the movie. Bring it in under 90 minutes and on budget or under budget. Mm. And we're happy. Then you can go nuts with it. You're 100% right. But now we look at it like, yes, we have to take this legacy seriously and make sure we pay homage to all of them. And you know what? You can.
Oh.
But after a while, that gets boring too.
Well, that's the result of home video, isn't it? People would watch these films over and over again, and they get to know the details that the filmmakers weren't even thinking about when they put them in those movies.
Or we just get accustomed to them. Yeah, you know? It's just warm blanket.
But this goes to an axiom I've been trying to coin for a while. Trash plus time equals culture.
Yeah.
The garbage of one generation informs the artistry of the next.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's happened with slasher movies. Slasher movies were junk. They were made on the cheap by studios who were just trying to make a quick buck. They weren't ever meant to be meaningful. But when you started to take them as a whole, meaning began to emerge.
Well, and also, it's also fair to say that different filmmakers, you know, you're given kind of carte blanche a lot of the time, as long as you're bringing it on budget and hit these bullet points.
Yeah.
Some tried harder than others.
Some
Wes Craven never phoned it in.
Wes Craven was a philosophy student, a professor, so he actually put a lot of thought into his slasher movies.
Yeah.
Even the bad ones, you can tell there's big ideas in them.
Yeah, exactly my point. Yeah, some people tried a little harder to make them feel like real movies. Some people didn't care.
John Carpenter was a little bit more of a workman. He just was such a natural master of the craft that his movies are just really gripping in that way.
Yeah.
And a lot of filmmakers just didn't care.
Yeah.
I find the Nightmare on Elm Street series to be really interesting because each one was helmed by like an interesting director who actually did try to bring some kind of style or nuance to it.
Again, that was a premise that unlike Someone in a Mask is Killing People over
those had a lot better effects, a lot more imaginative.
Well, but that's the thing. You have an excuse to be imaginative. Like we get to do dream sequences.
In dreams, yeah.
Dream sequences, everyone's going to have some wild ideas for that. And you have carte blanche. You can put whatever in that you can afford.
Right.
And we have time for it. Just knock yourself out. And so even in the shitty Freddy movies, and there are some shitty Freddy movies, there's neat stuff.
There's fun dream sequences.
Yeah, exactly. So again, I think the solution for the Halloween franchise, just keep churning them out.
If you must make them,
keep churning them out. Stop overthinking every single one. Mm. Just crank them.
That's how they did it in the 80s, and that's how you could do it.
That's why we care about it now.
So, make a shitty one, then make another shitty one. Make several shitty ones.
As long as you make them cheap, they'll make money, and then you can make another one. This is the reason why we never got any more Friday the 13th after that remake, which was a good remake. It cost too fucking much.
It cost too much, and also the movies have been caught up in like a big rights.
Before that. Like they had time to crank out one or two more before that hit.
Yeah.
My point is, they didn't. Because even though that movie made a lot of money, like on paper, it was a weirdly expensive slasher movie.
Slasher movies shouldn't be expensive.
Your slasher movie, even today, no slasher movie should cost more than $10 million.
Yeah.
No slasher movie. It makes no sense for a slasher movie to cost more than $10 million. You do not need it. Right? So when you keep them cheap, even if they don't do great, you'll break even.
Mm.
That's it. And then as long as you can keep it alive, you can keep that franchise valuable, you'll have more opportunities for people to come in, give them a small budget, a short period of time, and carte blanche, and they might do something fascinating that changes it forever. I guarantee you that, like, when Jason became a zombie in Friday the 13th Part 6, there were people who were mad, and now that's the default Jason. It is. It's the undead Jason is the one we think of. That was the sixth movie that they did that.
I am, however, you know, we're thinking about, you know, just sort of make the movie. And I feel like when you're making a horror movie about a serial killer in a mask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're making drive-in entertainment at that point.
I feel, though, we are so far removed from making that interesting anymore. There's a documentary film out there called Going to Pieces, which is about kind of the rise and fall of the slasher as it happened throughout the 1980s.
Yeah.
And how we kind of... The genre ran its course. When the slashers were revived by Scream in the late 90s, that was sort of this self-aware wave of them that's, you know, was now being watched by the people who had grown up seeing a lot of slasher movies on VHS. So they knew the tropes, and now the characters in the movies were commenting on the tropes.
Because now they're us.
Yeah, they're us, and, you know, media self-awareness was a big part of, like, 90s culture anyway.
Yeah.
And I feel like once that wave petered out, we're kind of done. Like, we made them, we commented on it, and now we don't need them anymore.
Yeah, you say that.
They don't serve the same kind of function anymore. They're not speaking to the same kind of generational fears. Now they're just nostalgia of nostalgia. And I feel like continuing to churn out Halloween films is really just milking a dead cow at this point.
Maybe.
So what do you do with the Halloween series? Kill it. It's okay to let things end.
Listen, I'm kind of fine with that, too. Yeah. My thing is this. Here's your job. We own this. We have to do it. That's the job. This is our job. We make Halloween movies here. Uh-huh. If you don't want to make Halloween movies, don't work at our company.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly valid. Right? This is what we do here. If you must do it, I have my own philosophy. If you have an opportunity to stop, I am fine with that. We've had a lot of Halloween movies. And who knows, maybe later down the road we'll do a remake or something again and it'll be new and fresh. Who cares? It's okay to say goodbye.
Yeah.
It's okay to put things away, even just for a while. Maybe permanently, but, you know, like, franchises do die.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about it very often. But, you know, the airport movies were huge blockbusters in the 70s. When was the last time you saw someone trying to exploit that IP? Speed. Speed was a huge fucking hit.
Oh, yeah.
Immediately greenlit a sequel, right? The sequel, so unpopular, they've never exploited it again.
No. That's kind of weird, right?
You'd think that, like, 20 years later, you'd try to get Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock back, right?
Yeah.
You would think that 20 years later, time for a remake or a legacy sequel, right? Dead. Speed 2 fucking killed it. And that's amazing that it was allowed to die. Because under normal circumstances, never in a million fucking years would that have been allowed to die. We would still have, like, an NBC procedural show about doing cop things quickly. In any other situation. So
it is, given that we live in an age where everything has to come pre-sold.
Yeah.
And the streaming services are just trying to milk whatever they can.
Yeah.
What was it Warner Brothers is going to bring back? They've been doing, like, another Gremlins or something.
They've done like a kids animated Gremlins thing. They're doing that.
They're bringing back everything.
They're bringing back
anything that was popular 40 years ago, they're bringing back.
Yeah, that's what they do.
So, yeah,
But you know what? Warner Brothers is
It is astonishing, though, that, of all of those things, Speed isn't one of the pots they've been plundering.
Warner Brothers, to their credit, is also putting out Sinners.
Okay,
and Sinners is actually a unique film.
Unique new thing.
As much as it can be. You know, obviously, no film is completely unique. But, like, yeah, that's actually, like, not an IP. They just put their support behind an interesting filmmaker, gave them probably too much money to do something completely weird. So it does happen. Question is, will people see it? We'll find out. Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We love reading your emails, even when they take us to task. That's how we learn. That's how we grow.
Yeah.
And if you want to write in for a future episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney will check the P.O. box before we record the next one. So, Whitney, what is the P.O. box?
Send us a letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. We're on social media at Critic Acclaim, on Blue Sky. I am at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
Huge shout out to our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Without you, our show could not exist, period. So thank you. You mean the world to us. We're very grateful to you. It's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork.
Did I say that? That's it. Yeah. Yes, you said that.
Okay, cool. I guess that's it. Thank you, everybody. Have a great everything. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.